This is a presentation of the Trine Broadcasting Network, part of the Center for Sports Studies at Trine University. Learn more at trine.edu.
Welcome to the Center for Sports Studies podcast. My name is Brandon Podgorski, professor of sport management at Trine University, and I want to welcome you to this week's podcast. On today's podcast, I am joined by the former chief financial officer of the Indianapolis Colts, Kurt Humphrey. Kurt was the CFO for the Colts for 37 years and one of their first hires after the team relocated to Indianapolis in 1984. In his role as CFO, Kurt was responsible for financial oversight and reporting, monitoring the salary cap, and working with players to help them understand the financial processes of the NFL. In this episode, he discusses these items in depth and provides some behind-the-scenes stories that can only be known by somebody who worked in a high level with the Colts. I hope you enjoy the show. So we are excited to welcome the former CFO of the Indianapolis Colts, Kurt Humphrey, to the show today. Kurt, welcome.
Thank you, Brandon. Joy being here.
Well, it's our pleasure to have you back to campus. I know you were here last year. I got to talk with some students, and you're here today. We're recording this early, but you're here today meeting with a number of students. So it's great to have you back on campus. And I know you kind of do this quite a lot. There's quite a few students that you work with colleges kind of around the state of Indiana, maybe from a mentorship role.
That's correct. I never envisioned this when I retired that I'd be going to universities and speaking to students and mentoring students, but Ball State, where I graduated, has me mentoring students during the year. And then Professor Martin asked me to mentor students here at Trine University, and I've mentored the last couple of years, and now I'm currently mentoring another. And there are some other students that I've given my business card to and have told them, I mean, you don't have to officially be in the mentor program. Just if you have a question about something that I said in one of my classes that I spoke at, just give me a text or an email or call. We could do a Zoom call. So I've tried to make myself available to more than one student, whether it's at Ball State or here at Trine, just to try to be helpful to students that are trying to figure out what they want to do or what they want to have on their resume in order to get a job when they get out of school.
And that's so helpful, especially in an area like sport management, where it is so much about experience, it's about networking, but it's also aligning your skills to the jobs that are out there. And I'm sure there's so many stories and just advice that you can bring in, because you were with the Colts for 30 years, is that right?
I was with them 37 years.
37 years, wow.
1984 when they arrived in Indianapolis till 3 years ago. I retired in April of 2021.
Wow. I mean, just so much experience for students to learn from. So let's start with that. Let's kind of go back as far as you want to go, and then we'll kind of bring it up to modern day. But just tell us about your background, because I know you didn't start in sport, but just kind of like happenstance, you end up getting in with the Colts when they moved to town in 1984. And then, you know, 37 years later, you have a long and distinguished career.
Yeah, I had no idea that I would be involved with a major league sports franchise for that many years. And when I graduated from Ball State in 1979, I started with Ernst & Winnie, when they interviewed me, they were Ernst & Ernst, and they merged with Winnie Murray out of the United Kingdom at July 1 of 79. So I started 5 days after that and worked there for 3 years, and ended up getting an offer from one of my audit clients, an insurance company, Baldwin & Lyons, every year after the audit by the vice president of finance, who previously worked for Ernst & Winnie. And finally, after the third year, he kind of gave me an offer I couldn't refuse. Mm-hmm. I started working for them in 1982 as their director of financial reporting, doing financial statements and 10-Qs and 10-Ks, and since they were an SEC company. And then the Colts came to town in 1984, and the girl that was the controller in Baltimore was not moving to Indianapolis. So their legal counsel, Mike Chernoff, asked Ernst & Winnie, who were their auditors in Baltimore, asked the Indianapolis office if they could recommend somebody to interview for the job. And fortunately, two partners from Ernst & Winnie called me and asked me if I wanted to interview for the job. And a week or so later, I did with Mike Chernoff, and he offered me the job that day at lunch. And I was there for 37 years.
Wow. So when you were at Ball State, did you major in accounting, I'm assuming?
Yes.
And were you an accountant and then kind of got into this role here?
That is correct. Yeah, I was. Okay. When I was in high school, I had no idea what I wanted to do in college. And I was just going to be a teacher as what probably the best thing that I could think of. And my mom was a typing teacher, and one of the guidance counselors came up to my mom one day and asked, what's Kurt going to do in college? And she goes, he doesn't know yet. And goes, would he like to go to this accounting club dinner on campus? And so my mom asked me, and I said, sure. Well, I knew nothing about accounting.
Yeah.
And I didn't take any accounting classes in high school, and I go to this accounting club dinner. Well, at the dais up front was Dr. Paul Parkinson, who I used to babysit for his kids. And I had no idea that he was an accounting teacher or professor or head of the School of Accounting at Ball State. And so I listened to him speak, and they had a guest from the FBI speak at that dinner. And they talked about how white collar crime was getting to be big back in 1975. And I thought, well, and accountants made pretty good money. And I'm like, well, this sounds like a pretty good thing to go into.
Sure.
But I knew nothing about accounting. So I go to Ball State in 1975, and your first year of college, you take general studies classes. Yep. So I was a sophomore before I'd ever heard of what a debit or a credit was.
Okay.
Or an income statement or a balance sheet. And I knew nothing other than balancing my checkbook.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how I got started in accounting. And I was in the accounting program there for the next 3 years and graduated in 79 and then started with Ernst & Young right after that.
Wow. I mean, and what a story. And I talk about that with students as well. Like, you know, obviously we've got sport management here at Trine, but you don't necessarily have to have a sport management degree to work in sport, because there's so many different opportunities and layers, especially in the front office. And I think that's something we'll get to here in just a minute. But, you know, I'm kind of interested in the CFO role, because there's some difference with accounting and finance. But in the CFO role in professional sport, what does that look like?
Well, I think it's similar to the CFO role in pretty much any industry. I mean, you're managing a group of people that you're preparing financial statements, you're preparing tax returns, you're doing budgets, you're doing cash flow analysis. One of the biggest differences, I think, in the NFL and major sports is, in some major sports, is you have salary caps. Mm-hmm. And I was involved directly with the salary cap when the CBA instituted it in 1993. And then the first year was an uncapped year. Then so from 94 on, I was involved with the salary cap. And so you have that's a separate piece that is kind of foreign to most industries. But we don't have LIFO and FIFO and inventories and things like that, like a lot of manufacturing companies would have. So there's differences. But the CFO role in general, I think, is fairly comparable to most other industries, whether it's football, baseball, Eli Lilly, a bank. I mean, you're managing people that manage the different payables, receivables, property, insurance, whether it's property casualty, health insurance, benefit plans, whether 401ks, pension plans. So you're managing anything having to do with cash.
Yep.
And you're preparing financial statements, budgets, and cash flows that have to do with cash. So I think most CFO roles are fairly comparable, although some of the line items that you're in charge of, like salary cap, are a little bit different.
So let's talk about that with the salary cap, because that's kind of fascinating. I think students would find that fascinating. So what was your role with that? I'm assuming you had to work pretty closely with whoever the GM was at the time. And, hey, we might want to bring this player in, but do we actually have the room to do that? What's the hit if we go over the salary cap? I mean, just all the rules you would have to know in the CBA as well.
Yeah, it started in 1993. Bill Tobin was our general manager. Mm. And I worked very closely with Bill and was in a lot of meetings with Bill Tobin and the player personnel people in the back. And it was accounts that are familiar with property and plant and equipment that have depreciation would be real familiar with salary cap. I mean, most items of your salary cap, the salary, reporting bonuses, incentive bonuses, are pretty much cash charges to a team, but signing bonuses and some roster bonuses get amortized over the life of the contract, which is like straight line depreciation there being for property. So I was the one that, because I knew accounting, I was the one that was asked to be in charge of the salary cap. And so I worked closely with Bill Tobin. And then in 1998, Bill Polian started as the general manager. And I worked directly with him for several years. And then he brought his son, Dennis Polian, into the business. And he and I both did the salary cap. And I would present in an Excel spreadsheet form, I would present different cash and cap scenarios to Bill. He would handwrite a list of all who he had one of the best penmanship of anybody. He would handwrite a list of all the players, like running backs, and list them down, and the wide receivers. And then I would put all these people into the spreadsheet and determine what the cap charge and the cash charge would be, and give him the printouts of that. And then he'd come back and revise a list and give me a list with other people in or out. And so we would kind of edit the list, and that's how we determine how much cash or cap to spend based on what players that he was upcoming going to sign in the future, or players that we currently had that we want to do extensions on, things like that. So he was a little more intricate in a lot of the things that he did, and he developed spreadsheets that I already had. I'd started with like two or three and ended up having like 16 spreadsheets that had different pieces on them that he could analyze, whether it was workout bonuses or dead money, which was from accelerated signing bonuses that get charged to a team, or likely to earn incentives or roster bonuses from a cash basis. So we had a lot of different spreadsheets that he instituted from what I had done previously with Bill Tobin. And then in 2012, he was gone after the 2011 season. 2012, we brought Ryan Grigson in as general manager, and we hired Mike Bloom, who used to be with the Denver Broncos. And then he took over all the day-to-day salary cap spreadsheets that he would give to the general manager. And I kept he did his in Microsoft Access. I did mine in Microsoft Excel, and we would compare each other's. And that was the first time that I had ever had somebody to compare my numbers with, because my numbers were used to do the payroll every week. So if I ever messed up on a cap amount for a player's salary, then I would know that at the end of the year when we would do this W-2 reconciliation. So fortunately, I never made a mistake on that as far as paying a player, but it was nice to have somebody else giving me their salary cap numbers in a different format so that I could compare to, just to double check to make sure both of our numbers were correct. And those, I would still give my spreadsheets to Jim Irsay, our owner, because he was familiar with the sheets in the Microsoft Excel format.
So all this is fascinating. I want to go like a million different places. So you just mentioned the working with the owner there, with Mr. Irsay. How much was he involved? How much did you guys work together? Because I know he's worried about the player side, and he wants to win, obviously, but there's this whole business side of it as well. And you've got hundreds of employees, you're trying to get sponsorships, there's community involvement. What part of that kind of played in with the Colts and on the owner side, kind of worrying both on the field and off the field finances?
Well, he typically, and I think this happens with a lot of teams, he would set the amount that we would spend on player compensation. A lot of times it's referred to as cash over cap or cash under cap. If the salary cap was, say, $150 million, you couldn't, and he would say, I don't want to spend more than $5 million over that cap amount in cash this year, or $5 million under cap. So, or it would be over a 2 or 3 year average, where he would determine that over 3 years, I don't want to be more than $10 million cash over cap, or whatever the number was. And so he didn't really care how we got there. He didn't get into the micromanaging and the specifics. It was just, this was our number that was our goal to be at. And then it was up to me and Mike Bloom and whoever the GM was to try to stay under that number. And the main difference between a cash amount and the cap amount is your signing bonus. Because most salary cap items, like salary, your incentive bonuses for the most part, a roster bonus, are all paid in a year, and their cap charge is the same amount in that year.
Okay.
Whereas a signing bonus, like I've mentioned earlier, is amortized straight line method over the life of the contract. So you may have a $5 million bonus over 5 years. So that's $1 million cap charge each year for 5 years. Well, if you pay that whole $5 million in year one, your cash is $5 million, your cap's $1 million, so you're $4 million cash over cap. Well, then years two, three, and four, and five, you pay zero in cash, but your cap charge is $1 million. So now you're $1 million under cap for the next 4 years. Well, you do that for over 90 players, the 90 that you start with, and then you have signed new players and you cut players, and you do that, keep track of that for however many people on your team, and your total aggregate, you want to be whatever the owner has kind of given you your marching orders for.
So for the signing bonuses from the player side, because we know not all NFL contracts are guaranteed, I'm assuming the signing bonuses are right up front for the players, and that's guaranteed money. So is there kind of an incentive for them to try to get as much as they can? And then for the team, hey, that's great. We can kind of, you know, quote unquote, depreciate that over the years.
Well, signing bonuses can be in a lot of different forms.
Okay.
You can pay, usually, signing bonuses of a player that are getting $3,000, $5,000, a smaller amount are going to be paid up front. But if you have some players that you're paying $5 million, $10 million, $20 million, sometimes you'll spread that out. You'll pay 25% of it up front. You'll pay another 25% in the end of June or in the September or into next year, next March.
Yeah.
And anything that you have not paid by March 31st of the following year has to be funded with the NFL in their this deferred comp funding program they have. So you can pay it out as long as you want to negotiate with the player, but you're going to have to pay it to somebody next March 31st, either to the player or to the NFL and their deferred comp fund. So a lot of that is part of the negotiation with a player. The more, obviously, they want as much as they can up front, but a lot of times you have an agent that will compromise and let you pay it out in three or four installments over the next year. Or there's some cases where you pay the signing bonus like you pay your salary. You pay it every week during the season. So there's 18-week season now, including the bye week. So you would pay $1.8 million signing bonus, $100,000 a week over 18 weeks, just like your salary would be paid over 18 weeks. Now, they changed that rule a couple of years ago for the players to save some of their money. They don't pay the entire 100% during the season. It used to be that forever. They had a change that the owners agreed to where you pay 50% of it up through the end of the season, then another 50% the next 17, 18 weeks.
Okay.
So, because the players really weren't making any money during the offseason other than maybe $1,000 a week for workouts, things, and during OTA. So they were trying to help the players, give them more money between February, March, April, May, June, before training camp would start in July, end of July. So now you pay that half during the season, half after the season. But anyway, a lot of that is just negotiated as far as signing bonuses and when you would pay those. The smaller the amount, usually it's almost all paid up front.
Okay, so that makes sense. And you said something interesting there. Do the players are only getting paid generally during the season, during the 18 weeks of the season, or they get paid weekly?
That's
Is that
correct.
How that works?
That's correct.
Okay. And I thought something else that's fascinating with players, it might not be kind of your average W-2 job that, you know, I work here at Trine, I just work at Trine and it's right from there. They get taxed in the different places where they play. Is that correct? Like the different states. So not only are you kind of worrying about, okay, what's going on here in Indiana, but if they're out, you know, playing in, you know, Texas, you're worrying about those taxes coming in too, right?
That's correct. It's called a non-resident withholding tax. And we're the only team out of 32 teams. We're the only team where our three division opponents that we play away, Tennessee, Houston, and Jacksonville, are all in states where there's no state income tax.
Okay, I thought Texas may have been, and I used them. Okay, I'm glad you corrected that.
So we withhold nothing on the players for when we play in those states. But
Okay. You
have a lot of states and cities that have local income tax. Missouri and Kansas City have taxes. Ohio, Cleveland, and Cincinnati also have taxes. Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh has two taxes locally. So what we have to do, what I have to do, is calculate what is their taxable income for that venue, that state. And I have another big Excel spreadsheet for every one of the states that we play in or cities, where you take their total W-2 income, not just what they made that week in Pittsburgh, but their total income. I have to project what their total income is going to be for the entire year, because they haven't played every game yet. So I got to project as if they're on the roster for the whole year, plus what they got paid in January if we were in the playoffs, what a player gets paid during their OTAs, what they get paid at training camp, any roster bonus, anything that's going to be on there. I have to, in effect, project what their W-2 is going to look like for that year. Take that times the 2 days that we're in that city, Saturday and Sunday, divided by their duty days, which it is their mandatory work days. So that really their mandatory days are like 3 days of minicamp, all maybe 47 days of training camp, plus 6 days a week during the season, because one day they're off. Plus, if they were on the roster back in January, or if even February, if they're in the Super Bowl, all of those count towards their mandatory days. So I'll take, say, 10 million times 2 days. Then they could have played 2 days back in January too, so it could be 4 days, divided by their duty days, which may be, say, 150 days. That's their fraction of taxable income for that state, times whatever that state tax rate is.
Yep.
They're all different. And then we withhold that from their check. So we could be playing a preseason game in Cincinnati, and I know we've had players come up to me, and they were so ticked off.
I was going to ask if you had, okay.
They're getting $2,000 for training camp money, but I'm withholding $8,000 in taxes. So typically for those players, we wait until the season when
okay.
the checks are big enough to start withholding the taxes. But they'll ask, I only made $2,000 this week, but how come I'm getting charged $8,000 in taxes? And that's why, because it's the 2 days is based off of their total income for the year, not just what they made that week.
Wow. So as far as like educating players, did you have to do any training, any education with them? I know the NFL has some programs with the rookies that come in on just kind of explaining just little intricacies like that, and maybe all the way up to, you know, maybe helping them with budgeting and so on and so forth.
Yes, I would do that for the state taxes. And then we would have a mandatory, usually in October, a mandatory 401k meeting.
Okay.
Because they're second career savings plan, which is in effect a 401k plan, started typically, I think, the November 1st, the first game played in November, through the following March 31st. That's when we could withhold. So it wasn't a 12-month calendar year withholding for their 401k. So I would have a meeting with them in October to explain the 401k program and how we withhold and why we withhold and the benefits for them putting in. And then there's a match involved that they would have. Like a lot of companies might have no match on their 401k or a 2% match. Well, they were getting matched $2 for every dollar. And then it went up to three. I think it's currently either $3 or $4 for every dollar, up to like $20,000. So they're getting matched. They're just getting free money.
Is that that vary by team?
No, that's a league-wide. Every team, all the players are on the same benefit program.
Okay.
Whether it's their retirement plan, their severance pay plan, their health insurance, their 401k, any termination pay, it's all negotiated benefits in the CBA.
Okay.
So they're all on the same plan. But so I would have a meeting with them every October to explain the 401k plan and how it worked and how the match worked, and they get matched whatever that match is the following year. And if they put in, I think it was at one time $10,000, then it went up to maybe $15,000. If they put not the entire 401k IRS limit in by November, in the November first check in November, which would include what they had done in March, so by the first check in November, if they were at the maximum amount, then they would get 100% match December 1st. If they didn't have the maximum amount contributed by the first check in November for that year to date, then they would get matched the following March 31st. So,
okay,
like a 4-month difference. So I would explain all of that. And then I would, every once in a while, players would come up to my office, and because I did this every day, and I would tell them, hey, I do this every day. I've done it every day for a long time. You guys are all new to this, and you're probably not going to remember a lot of this, or it might be a little confusing. So don't ever hesitate to come up and see me, and I'll re-explain it, and I'll let you know the pluses and minuses of when to do it, how much you can do, how much you have left to do, mm-hmm. things like that. So I'm continually talking to players, whether informally in the hallway or back in the locker room or in a formal meeting like for the 401k.
Yeah, that's really remarkable, just all the resources that players have available to them, because, you know, with a pro player, there's just so much coming at them.
Well, they had this program called Player Programs that was started back in the late 90s, I believe, and one of the pieces of it is it to bring in like a professor from one of the local universities to explain to them about wills and probate and beneficiaries on all of their things involved in their estate, whether it's their investments or whether it's in an IRA or their 401k or any assets they have, how you should have beneficiaries and or trust agreements set up so that a probate judge doesn't decide who's going to get your estate when you die, because everybody will die at some point. So I tried to explain all of that to them. So initially, I ran the program. Then I was like, you know, I'm going to bring in some professor from IUPUI. This was like in the mid-90s, and they started doing it. Well, then we had another guy that Bill Polian hired, and he started running the player programs, and I'm not sure who all he had come in to discuss it, but the league does have this where they tell the players about benefits like this or about dependencies, like a drug dependency or things like that, where like a hotline that they could call if there's some issues with them or their family. So we've tried to do many, there were four different pieces to the player programs where we've tried to do many things to help the players, all geared for life after football.
Yeah.
Because all of this, all the money they're making and all the things they're doing is only going to last so long. We're trying to prepare them for life after football.
Do you think they were pretty receptive to some of that training that they would get?
They were very receptive.
That's good.
They're very engaging. I mean, Peyton Manning had some of the funniest lines, because I remember every year, and he would ask the same question every year. And one of the pieces of your 401k is that you have to have a beneficiary. And it assumes if you're married that your wife is the beneficiary. Mm-hmm. So if you want somebody other than your wife to be the, and I would say this, if you want somebody other than your wife to be the beneficiary of your money, you're going to have to sign this form. And Peyton would go, do you think that's a good idea to not have your wife? So then all the players would start laughing. And I'm like, well, that's between you and your spouse. But some players and their spouse want to have their kids as the beneficiary or their mom or somebody other than, because they already have stuff set up in retirement for the spouse. So, but anyway, you have to have a notary sign that my wife has agreed the spouse will not be the beneficiary. Of the benefit of that policy. So that was that whole story. And he would ask that same question, but a lot of them would have a lot of really good questions, and they were all very engaged in all of these 401k meetings every year.
Wow. Well, I mean, their career is so short on the average, and, you know, you get that short amount of time to make really kind of life-changing money for your family. So, you know, that's good to hear.
Another funny story is these players were getting matched $2 for every dollar. Well, then $3 for every dollar. So if they put in $10,000, they're getting $30,000 put into the plan for free.
Yeah.
And Tony Dungy came up, a former coach came up to me one day. He goes, Kurt, I want to know all of the players that are not going to do 100% because I'm going to write a check to them. And if they'll sign over their 401k plan rights to me and have the money withheld, I'll personally write them a check for $10,000.
Wow.
So it'd be funny.
Yeah.
And then Hank Coleman, who was our special teams coach, he came up to me, he goes, Kurt, I want a list of all the players that are not maxing out on their 401k. I'm like, why, you want to have write a check to them? He's like, no, I don't want them on my special teams. They're not smart enough to play for me if they're not doing the maximum out on their 401k.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, wow. Well, you know, I'll kind of bring it back a little kind of more high-end type of thinking with the CFO role. So much money coming into the NFL, billions and billions of dollars. What are kind of like the main sources of revenue that you saw from the league or teams? And then on the other side, from the team standpoint, what were your biggest expenses? I'm assuming payroll, but I know it costs a lot of money to operate facilities and all the other things, travel and everything else that goes into it.
Yeah, the main sources of revenues are TV money. Oh, I mean, national TV money. And you have different buckets of money. You have national and you have local revenues. Mm-hmm. And the national revenues for TV and radio is the number one revenue item. And national sponsorships through the NFL Network is included in that, and all the advertising done on national. So those are two of the biggest national revenues. You also have local ticket revenue. That's a large piece of your revenue. You have naming rights in your stadium. There's another local. You have suite revenues, which is outside of ticket revenues. And you have parking and concessions. And so every team has different naming rights, parking, concessions, revenues, and same with suite revenues. And then your biggest expenses, like you said, were payroll. Player payroll is by far your biggest expense, and then administrating all non-player payroll, I should say, coaching, player personnel, the tickets, administration, your salaries, compensation is next, and along with benefits. And depending on the stadium, it could be stadium rent. Mm-hmm. Some stadiums have a lot higher rent than other stadiums. We have a very good deal with the city of Indianapolis, and ours is a very positive deal. But a lot of stadiums have really high rent for their stadiums. So those could be. And travel expenses. I mean, traveling to the games, when you're spending a couple hundred thousand per flight to take a plane. Like during COVID, you had to take two planes. So, because they didn't want the players on the same plane with the staff and a lot of the other people that are going. So you have a lot of away game costs, the hotel charges. You have home game costs, all the ticket takers and guards and ushers and stadium security and then the hotels. So a lot of the game-related costs is a really high cost, whether it's home, away.
My wife was fortunate. She was a flight attendant for Delta, and she got to work two of the Colts charters as their flight attendant. Sure. And when she was telling me everything they got to eat on the plane, I'm like, wow, that had to be really expensive, but really nice.
I remember I used to go on a couple trips a year back in the 80s and 90s, and you get on the plane and there's like a giant cheeseburger and a sandwich, and these are for the players.
Yeah.
But there's a one on everybody's seat. So they're primarily trying to feed the players. But you get on, you have a giant sandwich and a sub sandwich, and then they'll feed you a steak or salmon or whatever big lobster in the air on the way to your trip. Yeah, especially on longer trips, a West Coast trip. And then you get to the city you're at around 4 o'clock. And then a couple hours later, you're going out to dinner because you typically leave around 2 p.m. You go to dinner, you have dinner, and you wake up the next morning and you have breakfast in the team hotel. And then you go to the stadium. If you're in the press box, you're getting all this food in the press box. Then you get on the plane, you have the same food that you had left. But I would gain like 10 pounds by the time I would go on one of these trips, and to a point where you just like can't eat all the food that they have. But the players, obviously, eating a lot, they burn a lot of those calories. Right. So
now, do players get per diem as well when they travel? And is that part of their salary? Is that different?
that they all get per diem. That's a negotiated thing with the league.
Okay.
They get a per diem for the meals that are not provided for them.
Okay.
So they get per diem for dinner. Okay. But they get fed on the plane, they get fed at breakfast, and they get fed on the way home, but they get per diem for dinner. Okay. And that, I believe there's maybe a lunch per diem because they're there for 3 days, even though they're not eating lunch. So they got like two different per diem amounts, but no, they get a per diem, and that's negotiated in the CBA what that's supposed to be.
Yeah, kind of an interesting thing. I don't know if people actually kind of knew that players got that money there. So thinking where we're at now with the NFL, and again, just so much revenue coming in just from different places. I think it's interesting the negotiations that they're having with both the cable and the networks, but now with streaming services. What do you think are the greatest threats facing the NFL from, and we'll kind of, I mean, if you want to look at league wise or even just individual teams.
Oh, it's from a revenue standpoint?
Yeah, from revenue, finance, you know, the cost, it feels just of everything is increasing. Now, I don't think it's going to harm the NFL as much as it might MLB, NBA, NHL. But, you know, what you might think are just kind of some of the greatest threats out there, maybe from a financial perspective coming down the pike.
Well, the number one threat that we already had once was the COVID.
Yeah.
And that was where you don't have people in the stands. So you don't have local revenues, and you're going to lose money from your TV partners from a percentage basis. So that's already been realized, and that's another potential threat that could come. You never know when you're going to have something like that happen again. Then the players' exposure to being the head trauma, the head injuries, and the CTEs that some players have had, and that's a negative as far as the players are concerned. Something that hopefully I know the league and the players association both are working to on new helmet safety and cutting back kickoffs and things like that. They're always working on trying to improve the health part of the game because you can't eliminate everything. I mean, it's a very physical, violent sport, but they try and do their best to eliminate a lot of things that have happened in the past to players. But that would be more of a player negative thing that could happen and has happened. But I would think the biggest negative, like I said, is probably a pandemic or something like COVID that would happen again, where you wouldn't have revenues because people couldn't go to the games.
We hope is a once in a lifetime thing that you could never forecast. So yeah, absolutely. Those acts of God, I mean, it just, you know, can really, I mean, we saw so many just small businesses kind of go belly up because of that. So absolutely. How many people did you have reporting to you when you were CFO with the Colts?
Well, when I started in 84, there were two. I had a girl that did payroll and a girl that did payables. And then when I retired, there were five people reporting to me.
Okay.
As a lot of teams may have, or organizations may have, more people report to the CFO, but our like heads of different departments reported to our chief operating officer, like sales, marketing, tickets reported to the chief operating officer, and our legal counsel, our general manager, myself, our chief operating, we reported to our owner. So, but I didn't have as many people in accounting or people outside of accounting. I had nobody outside of accounting reporting to me.
Okay. So you had a little bit of a smaller staff, because I know some teams, they route a lot of people up to the CFO.
Yeah.
So maybe you can speak on Mr. Irsay's behalf. He had so many people kind of coming to him, and in your relationship with him, I'm always interested on the leadership side of sport, just because so many students, they're going to graduate, and before they know it, they're going to be in managers or they're going to be leaders. What were some of the things you felt that he did well as a leader to kind of move the organization forward? Because from where they were in 84 and struggling in the 80s and 90s to where they are today, I mean, it almost feels night and day as somebody from Indy. Yeah.
He was very good at recognizing talent in a lot of areas, whether it's football players, for people to manage the different departments. And he wasn't a micromanager. He hired people to do their jobs and let them do their job, whether it was me or a chief operating officer or legal counsel or general manager. I mean, he would be involved in major decisions if we were going to have to add an extension onto the building, or we're going to have to sign Peyton Manning or Andrew Luck to an extension, or any major football related decision or financial decision. He would be very much involved in the salary cap and budgeting, the cash flows. I mean, he was very big on our cash flows that I would prepare, but he would let people do their jobs. I mean, that's his, he was the best boss you could ever have to work for.
Oh, wow.
Being so compassionate. And just, I know a couple times I would usually go to my grandmother's or my mom's for Thanksgiving. And one year he had heard that my mom had open heart surgery that summer, didn't want to fix Thanksgiving, so I was just going to be by myself. And he had heard I was going to be by myself, so he had texted Pete Ward, our chief operating officer, tell Kurt to come over to my house. And I asked Pete what he wanted. He goes, I don't know, he just wants you to come over. Well, he wanted Pete and his wife and myself to come to his house for Thanksgiving. So he didn't want me being alone on Thanksgiving. And he did stuff like that all the time, for whether it's people that he knew or people that he didn't know, people that he would read about that their house burned down or something like that. He was such a generous, compassionate person that there's so many. I mean, I could tell hundreds. Well, I probably can't tell hundreds of stories of where he's helped out people. And yep. He's just such a generous person, a compassionate person, and very knowledgeable about cash flows, salary cap, and players and hiring people.
Well, I would hope, as an owner, you would want to be involved in some of that, just because it seems like these organizations with these pro sports teams are so big and they're so intricate. I would imagine having some of those skills where you're understanding the cash flows and where the money's coming from and how it's going to be allocated, it's going to put you at a competitive advantage.
I mean, it was a big advantage for him, because a lot of these owners are coming from, they owned Home Depot, or they own some business outside of football, and it'll take them several years and decades if they want to put in the time to understand the intricacies that goes on in putting a team together, or the salary cap, and he worked for his dad, worked in the equipment room back when he was in high school and college. So he's grown up in the business and knows the players. He played football at SMU, and he's known about the sport since he was a child, and he's grown up in that, and he's learned the business aspects of it along the way.
So it's going to be hard in 37 years to maybe narrow it down to one, but I'm going to assume 2007, but I don't want to assume. Do you have a favorite memory of working with the Colts?
Yeah, my definite favorite memory was when, you may not think it winning the Super Bowl, or you might think that, but my favorite memory was the game that got us to the Super Bowl.
I agree. Okay.
Yeah. When we beat the New England Patriots in the 2006 season and came from, 26-3 behind, something like that in the first half, and kicked a field goal at the end of the first half and then came back and won. That was the number one, knowing that you're going to, because there's so many there's four teams that have never been to a Super Bowl, and there's 11 or 12 that have never won a Super Bowl, I think. And it's hard to explain the feeling, tears, joy that you have, knowing you're going to get to go to a Super Bowl, your team's going to get to go to a Super Bowl, and then winning the Super Bowl was 1A. There's 1B. If there's a 1A and a 1B, I mean, it's just barely behind. But that was getting to go down on the field and hugging Adam Vinatieri and hugging the other players. He was the first person I saw. And it was just – and then the after-game party and having – and then Mr. Irsay providing a Super Bowl ring for every single person in the building.
Yeah.
I mean, if you were like a vice president or above, you got the same ring that the players got, players and coaches. If you were, they've been there from 2 years to 15 years, you got kind of a you got the same ring, but without diamonds in it, I think. And then I think all the interns and one or two of your people got like class ring, like Super Bowl type of rings. And everybody got some sort of a ring. And it was he was just very generous to everybody. And that was by far the two one time biggest moments. The winning against the Patriots and then winning the Super Bowl. Those were 1A and 1B.
And I got to imagine it might have felt maybe just a kind of a little cooler on your end because, you know, some people in the business office, like if I'm selling tickets, that's my job. I'm selling tickets. I don't really have an impact on what happens on the field. But you did have a little bit of impact there, especially considering everything you were doing with the salary cap, how close you worked with the general managers. Some of that work you actually got to see on the field there.
Yeah, you know, I never really thought of it like that. I just thought, I mean, every single person was happy.
Yeah.
Every single person was a part of the organization. That's the way Jim Irsay treats people, and that's the way all the department heads, I think, are like that, is that no one person is any bigger than anybody else. Yeah, you might have a more responsibility because your title's is higher than somebody else's, but everybody plays a part some way, shape, or form in the successes that you have with the team. And I don't know I can't speak for other people, but I never really thought of it like that. I just thought that, I mean, everybody had worked so hard to get to that point, and this was the reward you had for all of these years of hard work for everybody. Because there were some people that, like you said, only been there a year or two, some that had been there as long as me and or longer. And it was just a reward for everybody. And to see everybody share in that success, that it was like a family thing. It's like at Christmas time, you're especially when you get older, you're happier when other people get gifts than when you get something. And that's what it was like. It was like Christmas, like the whole family was getting a gift, and I wasn't any bigger than anybody else.
All right. Fair enough. So last question I have for you, you know, we started this show off, we're talking about mentoring for those students who want to break into sport. What advice would you give them?
Well, it's kind of a supply and demand thing. I mean, there's more people that want to get into sports than there are sports jobs available. So you have to do, like, I didn't start off, my track wasn't to get into sports. It was to try to be the best accountant that I could be. And that's hopefully what I did along the way. But I was in the right place at the right time to be in a sports world. But I know we at the Colts, we have a lot of internship programs in all the different departments. And I would say just try to send out resumes as often as you can. Try to make contact with people. Try to have internships. If you can't be in sports with one team, try it whether it's the Indiana Pacers, whether hockey team or a local baseball team, or try to get involved either in a minor league level, because there just aren't enough jobs available for everybody to go right into professional sports.
Yep.
I mean, typically you have to have some experience. Even people that are in sales aren't just going to go right out of college into sales. They want people that have sales experience. And so you want to try to, you may not be able to get into like professional football, baseball, basketball, hockey, but you could get into the minor leagues. Try starting off that way, but sending resumes or, don't ever hesitate thinking you're sending too many or you're being a pest or whatever. And just try to send out as many as you can. And even if you don't get into the sports, you can possibly down the road after you've done internships or gotten jobs out of college in other areas, try to be the best you can at that job, whether you're with a banker or you're with a insurance company or you're with a manufacturing company. Try to do the best you can at that and build up your resume, because at some point in time there may be an opening with the professional sports team that you want, or maybe in another city. And just keep looking, because a lot of these teams will put out their HR departments will put out when they're looking for somebody in an area. And you may end up going in an area that you really didn't go to college for, but if it's something you really want to do, you can get your foot in the door that way. You might get into sales or a ticket office or whatever. You may not be in accounting, but you're somewhere in the organization just to kind of get your foot in the door.
Yeah, and if you keep working hard at that job, eventually you're going to shine. Somebody's going to see you, right?
Exactly.
So that's great advice. And Kurt, we really appreciate you. 37 years, the CFO of the Colts. It's been great information. And, hopefully students listen to this and get inspired to start their journey.
Well, I appreciate you having me on. I would have never have thought when I retired, I would be going to Ball State and Trine University and mentoring students and speaking to classes and taking piano lessons when they're doing it for 2 years. So I've thoroughly enjoyed being able to talk to students and kind of let them pick my brain or give them suggestions on what they want to do to add to their resume, to separate themselves from hundreds, thousands of other students that are going to be applying for the same jobs.
Great. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. Be sure to check out our social media pages for our next guest coming up soon. As always, we'd like to say a special thank you to producer Josh Hornbacher for his work behind the scenes. This is the Center for Sports Studies podcast, broadcasting from the Trine Broadcasting Network. If you like this episode, please be sure to subscribe to the Center for Sports Studies podcast on your favorite podcasting platform and give us a 5-star rating if you like what you heard. For more information about the Center for Sports Studies, please visit trine.edu. Also, be sure to like the Trine Center for Sports Studies on Facebook, follow us on Instagram and X at TrineCSS, and subscribe to our YouTube channel.
Thanks for listening to this presentation of the Trine Broadcasting Network, part of the Center for Sports Studies at Trine University. Learn more at trine.edu.